Review of total portfolio performance of Damon and Marty.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
One of the advantages you get in me being partly retired is that you get three of us instead of two. Happy to be here. You've seen this. This is the Kuhn's report that was discussed at Sackers. You know that your performance, and this goes through June, but you know that your performance through June and through September has been very strong. The total return of your fund is first quartile over all the trailing periods, which is fairly amazing, actually. And so I'm happy to add perspective where I can. The way we're going to present the report is Dorian's going to talk about the capital markets, and Marty's going to talk about the individual managers that you have, and I'm happy to break in wherever I feel like.
Great. Well, I'm going to cover some stuff on page one in your report. And taking a look at the economic backdrop, probably the biggest news over the last quarter has been what the Fed has been doing. And just to sort of bring you up to speed on that, you remember that a year ago, the Fed was buying $85 billion of securities every month as part of their quantitative easing program known as QE3. Last December, they announced that they would start slowing that purchase down, the tapering, and this year, and they meet twice a quarter, with every meeting they decided to ratchet that down. So in the October 28th and 29th meeting, they said starting November 1st, we will be buying zero. So QE3 is gone, it's behind us, and now what? So the big question now is, when will the Fed start raising rates? Well, I would say in the early spring, we sort of had a sense that the Fed might raise rates somewhere between 6 and 12 months after they concluded QE3. In fact, Janet Yellen was caught saying that it would be at least 6 months, and the media picked that up to mean as soon as 6 months. Well, from where we sit today here in late November, I think a lot of people feel that 6 months is, well, that's not really going to happen. It's probably going to be at least a year. And we may keep having this thing where every month it feels like it's at least a year. I think realistically the thought leaders that we speak to out on the street and working with your managers are thinking late second half is probably the earliest we're going to see rates rise, although it may not happen until 2015. And if I think back to 2016, and when I think back, actually, we've been talking about, well, rates are going to have to rise soon. We've been saying that for 6 years now, so it might be 7 or 8 or 9. Predicting the direction of rates is one of the hardest economic things out there. It's so easy to get wrong, and so I would say any decision you're making, don't say, well, we're sure rates are going to increase at this point in time. The one thing that I think we have a little bit more comfort on today is perhaps some of the drivers that the Fed is looking at. A year ago, the Fed was talking about when unemployment comes down to 6.5%, then maybe they'll start raising rates. That seems a little overly simplistic because the Fed looks at a lot of different factors. And you would have to think that that may be a driver at any point in time, but when you look at the totality of everything, it's really more of a mosaic approach. Some of the other things that we've heard about, and by the way, during the third quarter, unemployment fell from 6.1 to 5.9, so we're well under that 6.5%, which was the original target. We've also seen GDP being strong. In fact, we just got the revised Q3 GDP this morning coming in at 3.9%. And the 6 month, two quarters together, economic growth has been the strongest it's been in a decade. So things look pretty good. Inflation, that's sort of interesting. Inflation has been flat the last 2 months. And now we're beginning to sort of pick up discussions about, well, maybe the Fed isn't so interested about unemployment if it continues to get better, or GDP if it continues to be strong, but rather, if we're not getting enough inflation, maybe they won't increase rates until we see some inflation in the economy. So if inflation stays flat, we may continue to see better unemployment numbers, better GDP numbers, and no increase in rates. So we'll see. One of the things that I thought was very interesting, going back to June 30th, oil prices were at $105 a barrel. As of the start of the hour, they were $74 and change. That's a $30 decrease in the price of oil. That's obviously keeping inflation low. Many people think that oil prices are not sustainable under about an $84, $85 price, because that's the marginal cost of production. So we may see some of that come back up. But right now, I think the key thing to watch is inflation. If we keep flat or 1.5 or 1.7 below the Fed's target of 2, maybe 2.3, depending on which metric you're looking at, we may not see rates rise. Moreover, I think the sense is that if rates do start to rise, it'll be slow. There's a chance, there's always a chance they might spike. Dan from Torchlight mentioned that in one of the more recent meetings here. But I think more of the consensus, it's going to be slow. When it's slow, that means your fixed income investments may have a headwind with rates rising, but because of the coupon payments and because of the rolling down the yield curve, you may continue to have positive returns on your fixed income investments when you have a slowly rising rate environment. So that's sort of it on rates. So what happened to the markets in the Q3?
I got some too.
Go ahead.
No, go. You go first.
You guys are like Jeff, really? Mutt and Jeff.
I'd hate to see you on a dance
floor.
We
got a slit here.
I don't know who's sat us together. Yeah. I was glad you mentioned energy prices, because in the overall outlook, I didn't see it. It was a factor. It was kind of Fed-centric in terms of rates and effects on markets, and maybe that's because those prices don't have a global effect, but I tend to think they do. Do you think that the price of oil issue is just seasonal, or do you see a fundamental shift in that market?
I would say the latter. Driven by a number of things. The production of oil in America has boomed since roughly 2008 as the fracking, hydraulic fracturing, techniques have been used on newly discovered shale oil and shale gas.
Right.
Not only has the oil production in America boomed to the point that we are on the border of being energy independent, and with the huge boom in natural gas, which is also very cheap, we have these two sources of energy that there's so much of it, there's so much supply, that that's basically bringing down the price. The information that I've been reading is suggesting that demand has more or less stayed relatively regular. There's not really a drop in demand. It's really that there's so much supply out there. And that trend, I think, is long-term, decade, multi-year type of trend.
So in that environment, you have, because it's a component of CPI, you see stability in CPI. What about its effect in terms of the industries that most utilize it? I'm thinking of the airlines right now. I haven't seen a break in an airline ticket.
Profits are up.
They do fly a fair amount.
There was a news thing that said that they're making a whole bunch of money.
Yeah, I would imagine they are. I know Southwest is. So I'm trying to understand if that has any long-term implications. Does it matter in terms of the bigger picture? What does it mean? I was looking at the performance of our the global and international funds and kind of wondering what, if anything, this means for those. I don't know if you can comment on that or.
Well, I would say from when I look in the crystal ball, the biggest long-term trend this means is America has an energy cost advantage compared to a lot of the rest of the world. So we've seen over the last decade an outsourcing of people to foreign markets because labor has been cheaper. Now, those labor prices have come up a little bit. America is still expensive from a wage perspective, but because the energy price is there such an advantage, you are seeing some large multinational organizations looking to build multi-year construction projects. Think about Gulf of Mexico oil refinery or natural gas export facilities where they're going to be billion-dollar plant and equipment, and they're going to be more expensive from a labor perspective, but because the energy costs in these labor-intensive areas, in these energy-intensive areas are so low here compared to other places in the world that it actually sort of balances out the labor costs. And so the total cost of building something in America versus overseas has become more equalized. So I think that's sort of the longer term ramification.
What about, I guess what I was thinking about was maybe the opposite end or the flip side of this, which is that as the price of oil has dramatically lowered in the mid-70s, I guess, that actually is going to put a chill on investment, for instance, the Bakken oil fields exploration. Those are all very price-dependent, I think, in terms of the ability to get a return on investment because of what you're pumping out of the ground and all of the expense you've gone to frack it and pull it out of the ground is dependent upon the expected returns at a much higher price of oil, but that's not happening. So the chatter I seem to hear is that you're going to have a decline in that investment and that certainly the marginal investors in that are going to pull away or go on hiatus.
Yeah. I think what you've described, will be something we see in the short term as the price of oil is at $74 and change and the marginal cost is $84.85, that production will slow down, so you get the glut of supply consumed, which should then bring oil prices up to the mid-80s or 90s. So I think we're going to have a little bit of a rebound to where we can get back to an equilibrium.
So you think the price of oil is going up?
I think it's going to get halfway back to where it was, which is saying the same thing in a different way.
Okay, so it seems to me that it's less stable. In other words, if the price is going to be affected by, you got a supply glut, people roll back production, or they go out of business or can't handle it, that crimps supply, demand, even if it just remains constant, the price goes up, but now the price of oil is much higher, so that kind of undercuts the argument that there's price stability and relative labor parity around world pricing, doesn't it?
Well, clearly, the if we go back up a little bit in oil price, that's going to impact inflation to some extent. It'll increase, but...
Well, I'm just hearing two different things. I just want to make sure I understand it, because it seems that like it has an effect. I don't know.
That's where I want to go, inflation. Right? I see college tuitions rising. It's already 5%, going another 5%, going another 5%. I see rents going up. You going over to San Francisco and try and find an apartment that's coming to the East Bay. I'm talking local, but I also think it's national. I see home prices going up. I see beef started going up 8 months ago or a year ago. Beef started to go up. So those, to me, are all signs of inflation. But it's a moderate inflation or even a less than moderate inflation. So I see inflation coming. But in gradual terms, and I've heard it discussed several times, that the system, the economic system, can tolerate gradual inflation and it'll be good. I lived in 79, 80, 81, 82. I applied for a loan at 14% for a house to get my father-in-law into a... I mean, come on, I don't want those days. I don't want that to happen. And now that I sit on this side of the table and I'm putting, we're putting our members' money out there, I want to make sure that we've got hedges against inflation. I want to make sure that it goes at, or at, be cognizant of how much it rises. So I don't know if you're saying you don't see inflation. That's kind of what I heard you saying. I see inflation, and I think inflation is coming, but I think it's coming at a very gradual level, and so we're not going to hit what we hit in 79, 80, and 81. But I want to be cognizant of how much it is going up and when it's if it starts to jump. And I want you to run to me 3 weeks before it starts to get jumping up there and say, hey, I see it now coming, and we better start looking, you know, to hedge it somehow.
Probably yeah. 6 months before then.
Yeah, that'd be great, too, if you
can't
do it.
Can't move that fast.
Dorian's tip sheet. Yeah, that's what you want. Yeah.
It's going to happen in a year.
Okay.
Well, in fairness, I will say I'm not an economist. And when I talk about inflation, I'm talking about the CPI-U metric that the federal government puts out. They've got a seasonally adjusted one, which they usually talk about for the last month. They have a non-seasonally adjusted one, which they talk about for the trailing year. Why they can't agree on one, I don't know.
And you know we base our COLA on the 9 Bay Area CPI, not the national or the – but that's – another thing, like yeah. CPI nationalism.
And so the glass half full guys like Scott may say that 1-2% is very slow and reasonable, and that when you have inflation experts up here talking about their portfolios and they get scared with inflation going to 3.5, which I also lived through the 70s, my student loans, I was not allowed to refinance. I kept paying those for a long time. 3.5 doesn't sound very scary to me, having lived through the 70s, but that's what's scaring the people who really look at inflation. The glass half empty is, well, if the federal government says these are the components that should go into the CPI, and you are facing educational expenses, your profile may look completely different from that CPI. And you may even suggest that the government is manipulating that CPI calculation to make it look good. And
when it
I won't go further than that because it's speculation.
Well, and I appreciate what Jerry's saying, and you're much better versed in it than I, but home prices are going up because they went down. You know, it's not that they're rising from here up here. They were down here going up. So I'm not sure if that's a component of inflation. They're just returning to natural market. Food costs are going to go up because we're in a drought. I mean, it's costing a lot of money to feed cattle and whatever. So I'm not sure I would call that inflation. I guess it is, but it's going to cost what it's going to cost. And student loans or college tuition, it's a policy issue that the governor in California, at least, is saying we're not going to put more money into tuition and that the student's going to have to pay it. Now, that's a policy issue, whether that's right or wrong, but I'm not sure the cost of the education has gone up. It's just who's paying for that education. So, you know, I take all that into account because I, too, lived through that horrible time, younger, but it impacted my family because my dad was unemployed a lot during that time. And so, you know, nobody wants to see us go back to that. But when I hear 3.5, I don't get too nervous about it.
And modest inflation is actually really good for the country because we have a lot of debt. And so there is a federal incentive for us to have some moderate inflation that will eat away the debt burden.
I don't mind moderate inflation. That's what that's what I was saying.
Yeah.
But
runaway? No, I was there. I had a 12% mortgage.
All right.
There, an unsecured loan in what 1982 or 83 was it about 21%?
Mm-hmm.
Unsecured. Crazy.
I want to say all this talk about the 70s is way before my time.
Sure was.
But there is a lot of talk about deflation. It hasn't come up yet, and the extent you might want to spend a few minutes on that, Japan, parts of Europe, and the implications of deflation for anyone who has, I think, looked at it in some reasonable way are far more damaging than inflation. And as a practical matter, you're going in one direction or the other. No one gets it at zero. You're either above or below that line, and I think the normal goal is to try and be somewhat above it, modestly.
Yeah.
But going the other way is incredibly unhappy.
Yeah, the the tyranny of deflation is if you can buy something today for a dollar, you can buy it tomorrow for 99 cents, so you put off purchasing. Well, consumer purchasing is 70% of our GDP. You know, even cutting that back a few percentage points can put you into a deflationary recession. And then people buy even less because the economy is weak and they're laying people off, and it's ugly. To John's question about what's happening around the world, it's interesting that the U.S. right now looks pretty good with that 3.9% GDP growth in the quarter. Granted, 10-year rates are relatively low at 2.3%, but we've finished our quantitative easing, which is basically throwing money at the problem. What we've got happening in Europe is you've got lower rates. I just pulled up some rates this morning. German 10-year rates are 0.7%. Spain, the UK, and Italy, 1.9, 2.0, 2.1. You're not getting, you're getting much less yield on your 10-year bonds than you are in the US. Moreover, they are getting less inflation in Europe than we are in the US. Year over year in the US, we're about 1.7. We're getting about 1% in Europe, and it's bordering on deflation. The ECB, the European Central Bank, is talking about how can we do maybe a form of QE, quantitative easing, somehow. Maybe the terms are a little different, but basically to sort of print money like the United States start to do 3-4 years ago and try to boost the economy and trying to get inflation up a little higher so you stay away from deflation. And we've certainly seen in Japan, the equivalent central bank in Japan doing something similar as Abe, and the fancy term Abenomics, the economics of Abe, coming in and creating fiscal stimulus, and actually in the last quarter starting to buy equities through exchange-traded funds to try to create inflation in Japan, which you're going to get some inflation in Japan and asset prices increases, but to sort of counteract that on a global basis, their currency has been sort of imploding. So if you bought Japanese stocks, you're going to get kind of a wishy-washy return. But if you're able to hedge that currency, you've done very well over the last couple of years. So the ECB is sort of in trouble. The euro's a little challenged because of the ECB. Japan, the yen is weakening. Kind of makes the U.S. currency look pretty strong. So globally, we have these sort of issues going on. How they all sort of fall out, we'll see. But to John's point, there is more of a danger of deflation when you have inflation around 1% than you do 1.7, which is what they're seeing in Europe. And they want to do something to get that inflation up to more like 2%, what we're seeing in the U.S., almost seeing in the U.S., and certainly Japan wants to do it there. So everybody around the world would sort of like to get at that mild, you know, 2% inflation.
Okay, go ahead, proceed.
Okay. So with all those crazy things happening in the world and Ebola, just a quick rundown of some of the market returns in the third quarter. Generally, the third quarter was a bad quarter for investing. The S&P was up about 1%, which was good for U.S. equities, but the Russell 2000, which measures small cap, was down about 7.5%. Mid cap was roughly in between. But to make this more of a positive meeting, the quarter to date, fourth quarter to date, we're about 7 weeks in, has actually been very good for U.S. equities. The S&P 500 is up over 5%. The Russell 2000 is up about 8%. We keep hitting new highs on the S&P 500, it seems, daily. And year to date, the S&P 500, U.S. large cap stocks, is up 14% through yesterday's close. The Russell 2000, measuring small caps, has lagged. It's up about 3%. And you'll sort of see that across the cap spectrum. The larger cap stocks in the U.S. have generally done better than the small cap this year, which is sort of a reversal of last year when the S&P 500 was up about 32%, and the Russell 2000 small cap was up closer to 40, 42. I forget the exact number. Looking at non-U.S. markets, very poor quarter in the third quarter. The developed markets is measured by the MSCI EAFE index. Europe, Australia, Asia, and the Far East was down about 6%. Emerging markets was down about 3.5%. Both of those are about flat fourth quarter to date. And year to date, developed markets as measured by EAFE is down about 1%. Emerging markets is having an okay year, up about 3.5% year to date. Looking at fixed income, the Barclays Ag for the third quarter was positive at 0.2%. This quarter to date, up just about 1%. And year to date, the Barclays Ag is up 5.3%. So that's a decent return in the high quality investment grade fixed income market. High yield, Q3 was down about 2%. Quarter to date, it's up about 0.5%. And year to date, it's up about 4%. So high yield has slightly underperformed investment grade, but not by too much. And those were sort of the market returns I was going to go over. And let me just sort of pause there to see if any questions. And otherwise, I'll let Marty take over.
Great. Thanks. A very quick follow-on. One thing you'll notice when energy prices go down is it stimulates the economy. It's like having a tax that's been reduced. So I save about $10 on every tank of gas, and I spend it on something else. So it stimulates the economy that way. So I'll cover the watch list asset allocation, then talk about manager performance, and stop me anytime if you have questions. The manager watch list is on page 3 of the report, and we have 4 managers on the watch list at this time. At the last performance review, we removed Adelante. The first is, my notes here anyway, is DBL, which is the Bay Area Equity Fund, and the valuation sheet, it's called Bay Area Equity Fund. And that was added to the watch list in the July meeting because Seth Miller left the firm officially in January, but we weren't informed until June. So that was really the reason for them being put on the list. Lord Abbott has been on the list since October 2013 because of personnel changes at the firm. Performance has never really been a problem there, and for the September quarter, they performed in line with the benchmark. There were a couple people in the research team that did turn over since October 2013, but that's sort of normal turnover, maybe even kind of on the low end of turnover. So, and we talked with staff about this, it probably is an appropriate time to consider taking them off the watch list. There hasn't been a subsequent problem.
I was going to ask you about that because I knew you were on the on-site when we went back, and it just seems to me that the performance has been there. In fact, their third quarter looked pretty stellar relative to others. So,
yeah.
I'll move that we remove them from the watch list.
Second.
That's Lord Abbott.
Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Abstained? Motion passes.
And PIMCO is also on the watch list. They were put there at the end of September when Bill Gross left PIMCO, which, of course, has been a big topic of discussion. September quarter performance was in line with the benchmark for your portfolio. And the PIMCO account has been moved to a separate account so that if you wanted to, you could terminate PIMCO quickly and easily. There are no derivatives being used, and there are no commingled accounts within the separate account. Before that, while it was a separate account, it was invested in some commingled pieces, a piece of treasuries, a piece of mortgages, for example. So things appear very stable there, things appear fine, but there is turmoil, and I would suggest keeping them on watch for a while and just making sure it continues.
We have
stable.
The firm basically rated as a hold at this point. Until some time goes by, you probably wouldn't hire them, but we think that it's a natural evolution that happened in a very messy way, and we think there's an awful lot of capability down in Southern California, and we're not rushing to get rid of them.
The question I had was, you know, we had those folks in, and we talked to them about, you know, things in general and things in specific, and I think a topic of a concern was the continued outflow and the potential that was going to create potential core meltdown scenario. I think we got a lot of assurances, and I know they're going to probably come back first quarter 2015 is what we decided to kind of take a little snapshot look then. I saw an article, I want to say it was last week, so it surprised me. It was in the journal about the continued outflow from PIMCO, not going to Bill Gross at Janus, but just in general the continued hemorrhage. Are you guys monitoring that? Do you have a way to monitor on some frequent basis whether outflows are continuing and if that poses a risk? And if so, what's the story?
Yes. So I actually asked them in the middle of October, or actually I should take that back, just before October was ending, and that is now considered material non-public information. So they're only allowed to tell people what the flows are as part of a monthly reporting because they think it'll affect the stock price of Allianz. But in the first couple of days of November, they did send out a memo and they showed us the flows. And let me see if I can sort of draw a picture. And
you want to put it on here?
Kind of look like that.
Can you see that? We've got the.
No. So it's a long.
So it's yeah. So when Bill Gross left, there were massive outflows.
Right.
And let's say the first 5 days was.
We're talking about assets, right. Not people.
Yes, assets. And then in the total bond fund, which is where they were seeing most of the flows, it's down to 3-5% with some daily volatility. We're going to continue to monitor that, and 3-5% of the peak outflow is still significant, but it's not hugely impacting. They can handle that amount of liquidity.
Right, but I mean, at some point, I mean, you know, I realize that we're still pretty close to the ground zero of all this and the messiness, as Bob alluded to, of it. But it just seems to me, at some point, doesn't the outflow stop? I mean, if you take a pinprick in a bathtub and it just keeps leaking, sooner or later, right, it's going to drain.
Just having a little problem with that analogy.
Got a bathtub full of water, right? A slow, steady leak from a small hole eventually drains the bathtub. So I'm just trying to understand. We're monitoring outflows, and I get that maybe it's less of a huge hemorrhage than it was in the beginning. But if it just continues, doesn't that suggest that they're not going to
abate? There's still one enormous amount of money there. It's going to take.
It's a big bathtub. I get
it. It's a
very big bathtub.
Yes.
And the leak has shrunk some. So it's coming out less than it was before.
Okay.
And mathematically, just to be cute here, if you lose 0.5% of your assets every day, 0.5%, you will never get to empty because it's sort of a curve.
You are getting cute.
Yeah.
The new math.
You get to a very small number, though.
University of Chicago.
Yeah. So we may continue to see some outflows. The glass half full would say the smaller that fund is, the more nimble it can be, and the more opportunity there is for active return.
Just to confirm what I think I understand, my concern has sort of reached the point that their key people are spending a good part of their time dealing with worried investors like us and lots of others, as contrasted to running the funds. Obviously, that doesn't lend itself to a nice, precise 8.3% something, but it strikes me as a very real issue. I think what we've done, and I guess I'm asking for confirmation on that, is to really insulate ourselves from that process. At some point, they'll be through it. At some point, most of this issue, concern, and challenges to their everyday environment are going to disappear, and they're going to go back to doing what they did before, and hopefully they'll do it as well as Bill did it. And we're reasonably protected during that process, and keeping them on the watch list helps us to remember that as we periodically look at it. So is that a fair summation and your thinking?
And the timeline about having them come in at the end of Q1 and even getting updates, say, early May. By early May, bonuses have been paid. Right. Professionals who are going to leave the firm will probably have left. A lot of the people who have decided we're going to pull out, whether they're 401k plans that had their fixed income investment with PIMCO or other people, they've had their 6 months to do their knee-jerk reaction. I think by May we should have a pretty good sense of is it back to normal or not. And in fairness, you obviously don't want to have your, as an organization, your key people on the road all the time and not doing the job. But in today's world of Blackberries and iPhones and a two-hour meeting is only 2 hours of the day. When you're on the airplane and when you're in the car and in the Uber and you're with your colleagues, you probably are still sort of thinking about the portfolio, maybe not 24 hours a day, but 22 hours a day. So certainly, yeah, senior people going around is a distraction, but with 264 portfolio managers, they're pretty strong.
Clients' decision process have different time frames. Some people made their decision immediately. Some people that are inclined to leave, it takes them a long time to decide. We should have gone through most of the people that were decided to get out right now already. Now, it's going to depend in the future on how many people stay around and how many assets stay around and what the performance is going forward. But most of the Bill Gross left, I got to get out of here, has already left.
My guess is that one of the things, it's just too difficult these days with the advent of social media and everything else to keep dissension quiet. So the idea that this is not a front page story anymore, that you're not seeing the melodrama every single day from all of these managers sifting out bad news, is a good sign. And to me, they're probably pretty much done with the apology tour too. So the next thing is going to be see if there's attrition after January, after December.
And see if the performance holds
but,
up.
But, you know, the Bill Gross is heavily medicated now, and he's he appears to be off the front pages, and that's good news.
Your comments, Dorian, when they were here, they said exactly the same thing because we asked them specifically about when would we know, and they said, well, and it was about client retention. I mean, not client retention, employee retention, and they said exactly what you said. Well, we give bonuses out in January, I believe it is, so we should know by the end of February and maybe March, and so that's when you ought to take a close look at how many people stay and how many people go and what's going on. So I'm looking at the first quarter, making a decision.
We've been down in Newport Beach, and a little bit of our sense is that people are happier, that it's of a
cool
a collegial atmosphere,
cool.
A distraction is gone. So we'll see how that. We'll see whether we read that correctly.
Well, they could be happier, and they could have a far lower level of performance.
Well, that is true. That's another dimension that we're looking at.
But every organization that has to deal with the as PIMCO turns melodrama on the executive suite, it's rough on the rest of the organization.
So you watch daytime TV?
I mean, it's brutal on the rest of the people to know that there's that kind of dissension in the. In the executive ranks.
Can I ask a question? How long, I know Nogales is on there until they're, when does the fund?
That was going to be they've liquidated everything except for one company, which is in a legal process.
So you see year, another 2 years?
It could, yeah. And we were going to suggest, and Marty hasn't gotten to it yet, to take them off because it's a rounding error at this point. It's if you look at the percentage of the total fund, it's 0.0%. And Marty points out that 0.0, it's
0.04. Yeah.
So it's so small as to not make
There's
any
no
difference. So why do you have to look at it every quarter? we would think you might keep it on there as an object lesson, but we think you might want to take it off.
Is there a motion?
Okay, I'll speak to the motion.
I'll move it. No.
I'll make the motion based on Bob's comment to remove Nogales.
I'll second.
It is a small amount. I know
it is a small amount, but it does mean that we're going to be changing the basis on which we put it on watch. If you read it, it says we put it on watch until they're completely wound down. That doesn't mean we have to keep being reminded of the pain somehow. But what we're saying by doing this motion is we've now changed the reason for putting them on watch. We don't care when they actually get wound down. So I prefer to not see it out of sight, out of mind. Well, somewhere or another, it seems to me we ought to know that Nogales is still hanging out there. And if it's on the watch list, that's a way.
What's the point of the watch list then in this case? And what are we watching out for in terms of Nogales?
To see if the last check bounces.
And so if it bounces.
To me though, Nogales is almost, I've never quite understood this continuing watch in the sense that I think the reason they're there is different than the other ones are, right? Where the other ones are active investments for watching. There's a particular reason. Typically, it's been personnel departure or money departure or both. It just seems like it's a bit of a one-off, I think, to Bob's comment about it being an object lesson. I think it needs to be an object lesson, but I don't know that the watch list is the place to make it that. I think it's already got, you know, a lot of attention. So I'd support the motion. And just suggest that we give it some special prominence and some
just a report maybe
some continuing mention of it or a reminder
of the legal
what
issue
it is. But
start a new session called the Hall of Shame.
Yeah, well, I wasn't going to say it, but thank you, Jerry, for saying. Yeah, it's one of those kind of things.
I like your analogy.
But it's but it does seem like I think to Rusty's point, the purpose of the watch list is really for current investments that have exhibited either a volatility or a change or a whatever it is that gets our attention. So I'd support the motion.
So what heartache or resources does it require to leave it on? I mean, it's just a watch. I mean, we know the investment has horrible performance, and we're watching until it's completely done. To Jerry's point, that's the policy, right?
Well,
it
no,
was when it got put on, at least.
It was the policy for why we did that. If it's two or three more years, I'm sorry. I don't want to see it there for the next two or three years because I'm assuming you guys are watching. You said there's legal things winding down.
Frankly, it's such a small piece that it's not worth
watching
a lot of anybody's time.
Yeah, I mean, the legal process will play out.
It's going to work out how it works out.
So you don't think it's material?
It's immaterial. It's 0.0% of your fund.
It's not material.
$10.
$3 million, John.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I hate to see it at some point saying, whatever happened to Nogales? I'm glad you brought that up.
Karen has a point over here.
My comment is that I believe that the investment guidelines have standards regarding under what circumstances the board is to put managers on watch. I would look at Tim for the details on that, but we would want to make sure that we follow those standards that the board adopted in policy. In other words, if you decide to take investment off the watch list, make sure it is in compliance with your investment guidelines.
Tim?
I'd have to go back and take a look at the exact language there, but generally speaking, as the board knows, you can put a manager on watch for personnel changes, organizational changes, or performance reasons. You take them off watch when your concerns are resolved. Now, your concern could be resolved by virtue of the fact that the investment goes to zero. That could be a possible interpretation. I'd have to go back and look at the exact language, though. It doesn't require any additional work on our behalf to leave them on the watch list. It requires about 3 seconds of work to take them off the watch list in terms of sending them a letter. But I think, you know, when we look at private equity investments, and you know, the board's comments are accurate, it's a special case. Everybody else on the watch list, with the exception of DBL, is a publicly traded manager. Things are actively evolving there. When you took the private equity land, if something happened at the organization you didn't like, short of selling it on the secondary market, you are going to hold that regardless. So having it on the watch list keeps you from putting more money with them. It's a reminder that something went wrong there. It is an object lesson. the fact that it's getting so small, is what is the object lesson today? Would be my question to the board.
Don't ever do that again.
Yeah, remind us.
Yeah, I just get concerned about having it drop off the radar screen altogether.
Well, if you, I'm not sure. If you look at, oh, sorry.
In real dollars, it's $3 million, so I hope.
If you look at page 18 of our report, you'll see that there are a few minuses in the fund level IRRs, and Nogales is one, but Long Wharf 2 is another, right. And Torchlight 2 is a third, and those are not on the watch list, so they certainly don't meet your performance standards, so you don't have to have people on the watch list. You make a decision at some point to put them on watch, and yeah.
A question I have regarding Tim's comment. So if we take them off, you send a letter to them saying they're off.
They've been removed.
They've been removed. Will that have any influence on their attitude about what we have invested with them? Will they say, oh, it's $3 million, the heck with it, we're not going to pursue going to drop the suit? Or will it have any influence on them one way or another?
No.
Well, and can't we word the letter that this isn't because we no longer are concerned about this account? It's that we understand you're winding down in litigation. I mean, you know, put some language in there that it isn't that we saw you doing a great performance. It's right. Just, you know.
However, they might be scratching my head, getting a letter saying you're off the watch list.
We have to send a letter?
Yeah.
Yes, if you remove it from the watch list, we're required to notify them.
And it also becomes public record. Public record or minutes, right. That we've removed them from the watch list, which could be read by the press as
generally removed from the watch list means rectification of the situation. That's not what's
That's
going
not
on
the
here.
Case.
So we need to have a never do this again list, so we can put them on a different list.
Well, I would expect staff would remind us of that if this came up again.
But the idea is the symbolism of taking them off without, and they just become sort of a footnote in history, I guess, is a concern, or I'm at least picking it up. I'm hearing that, and I get that. It's almost like there needs to be another list, which was, Jerry called it the Hall of Shame, whatever you want to call it, that is the lesson learned, or the so that it has a place etched, right? It didn't just vanish off the watch list and we sent them a letter and then it wound down and life went on. That there's somehow it's remembered formally. I'm sensing that's
yeah.
Important.
The simplistic approach to this is the board taking them off watch or leaving them on will not change how staff monitors this or how the consultant monitors this investment. So the question to the board is leaving them on or taking them off watch list useful to you as a board?
I don't see any advantage.
I don't see any advantage to taking
leave
them
it
off.
On or I mean
but
to
Bob's,
taking it off.
To just a question for Bob. I mean, you mentioned Long Wharf and the Long Wharf 1, I think, or 2, and the loss that we've incurred there. That is another situation where it's almost wound down. We did have them on watch at one point, right?
Yeah,
for a long time.
The difference here is between Nogales and the two others that I mentioned is you've had good experiences with other funds of Long Wharf and
right. Where we went into the subsequent funds and they actually turned around and did
quite
well.
Or in the case of Torchlight, you had an earlier fund that's totally wound down and had a very good return. So in the aggregate, you could say, well, these guys have done okay, right. Whereas Nogales has just been a problem.
And is Nogales still in operation, or are they winding down everything?
Well, I don't see how they can sell any new fund, given what happened to this one.
So that would be the differentiation for me, is the entity as a whole in trouble, that I would want to keep them on watch.
Okay, that's fine.
$3 million is $3 million, and maybe a 0% on these reports, but it's still $3 million.
Yeah, we wanted to explore how you felt, since it is de minimis.
We're spending way too much energy on this, so
I'm
going to withdraw
my
motion, and we'll just let it ride.
We'll let it ride.
Very good. Okay.
Well done.
Marty, are you going to go through the report, like the returns?
Yeah.
What, I've heard you talking about the ones that are on the watch list. What if we have a question about somebody that we would want to find out whether or not we should put them on the watch list?
Sure.
And I'll go to page 14, and I'll go to the analyzed performance before fees, global fixed, Lazard. And it says that they are on the 3 month on the 79th percentile. So that means there's, how do I want to put, 21% are better or worse?
Worse.
Well, yeah. That
79% are better.
We don't worry so much about the 3 month. If you go back to the.
Yeah, 1 year, the 2 year, the 3 year is 82%. The 4 year is 77.
Well, you also look though at what their benchmark index did,
right?
And you can see that over the 3 years and the 5 years, they've done better. On a before fee basis, they've done better than their benchmark index. So we would not. It's not exciting performance, and it's and the peer group, which there may be some issues with the peer group, I'm not sure, because certainly they've done okay.
Okay.
Not great, but okay. They've outperformed their index. So,
okay, so,
so that's why fees. We're not bringing those forward.
And, all right.
And after fees,
they're three, still ahead.
Yeah, 3 or 4 years are still ahead.
So the other ones that jump out are, in terms of problems, are, well, Intech is not too exciting. Over 5 years, they're right on the S&P and above the median, so they're not, and they've we understand done fairly well in this quarter to date, so they're not a candidate. They're somebody we're going to be continually watching. Most of your managers have actually done pretty well.
What about Allianz? When I look at the Allianz after fees across the board, they have not met the benchmark ever after fees.
Yeah. Before fees, they have. It's.
I mean, why not buy an ETF, right?
Yes,
definitely.
And I'd have to go back and look, but if it's a recent quarter with the ad poor performance,
I'm looking it drags
at everything down.
I'm looking all the way across the board.
If you look at the past year, you can see they've really had struggles the last year, which, as Marty says, pulls down the historic performance. And you look at the 5 years versus the let's see, I'm looking at the. They barely beat the index before fees, behind it after fees.
I'm looking at your page 20 after fees.
I'm on 14, but so 20
when you look
also.
At the aggregate, does the aggregate have fees involved? It seems like it's the same whether it's before or after.
It's just the index, so there's no fee deducted there.
So when you're looking at the index, does it take in consideration what their fees are if you're a user? Mm-hmm. So how could you factor that in? That's something you consider.
Well, that's actually one of the reasons we look at the. Well, you could buy an aggregate for not very much. You could buy an index fund. Mm-hmm. So
it's not significant enough to factor.
Fees almost be zero. I mean, a few basis points.
Okay.
Index funds will run between 0 basis points and 20 basis points. 20 on the really exotic stuff. But for most of the common stuff, you're looking at single digits of basis points. So 2, 4, 7. For high yield, I imagine it's probably 8 or 9. I could be off by a couple.
Yeah, so in terms of Allianz, the last year has pulled it down. If you look at them, after they've had a good year instead of after they've had a bad year, they've delivered value. So it's not exciting. You could go to an index fund.
$340 million.
Here's the other question. If half of your managers had really strong outperformance and half of them had very similar to benchmark-like performance and none of your managers had very poor performance, would you be happy with your portfolio?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would.
It's true.
Yeah. Well, maybe this is one of them that is in that second group. Okay. Of course, you fire the guys in the third group.
Marty, is this a good time to take a break in your walking us through this presentation?
Sure. I had very little left if you want to wrap up.
All right, we'll go ahead on it. I'm just looking at 10:30 and saying...
Okay.
No. Okay.
Well, the only manager that kind of stuck out in a strong way to me was Ceradex, because they had a tough third quarter. But they've made back most of that underperformance since the end of September. So part of it is just what day do you take their temperature and mark them to market? So they've actually gained back 1.6% relative performance since September. The two that we highlighted last quarter, Emerald and Rebuco Boston Partners, have bounced back as well during the September quarter and made back most of the underperformance that they had in Q2. So they're actually looking quite good. One that's different is First Eagle, which you'd expect to do relatively well in a bad quarter or tough quarter like the third quarter was. Gold was down as well. So the equity was down, market was down, gold was down. They hold gold, usually acts as a hedge. Usually stocks are down, gold goes up. It didn't happen that way in the third quarter. So they did underperform, which is unusual for them in a down market. But those are the only things to really highlight that we had never spoken about.
Okay.
I'm glad you pointed out Ceradex in terms of the rebound after.
Yeah. That's helpful
to know.
Debbie?
Yeah, I'm not sure if this is just maybe something went wrong on the report here, but starting at the bottom of page 16, this appears the same on the after fees report, but starting on the very bottom of page 16 where Bay Area Equity Funds is highlighted, the way it's presented here would indicate to me that 54.7% and that 70.7% is the aggregate of the two funds that we own, one and two. But if you go down to the one and two, I guess, you know, there's nothing in the 1 year and 2 year returns. So I'm just wondering how we came up with 54.7% on Bay Area Equity Fund with nothing in the detail, and a 6.4% on 3 months. I mean, I can see where the 6.4% would average the two on 3 months, but the 54.7% seems to be the average of nothing.
Yeah, that's what I'd have to check on. And I don't have the prior quarter performance report with me. Or do you guys know?
What I believe this is we're showing the aggregate return of the Bay Area Equity Funds in the top number, and then reporting starting this last quarter on breaking them apart so you can see the performance of the individual funds. So you're looking at composite level, which has always been tracked, and now starting to show the individual funds.
So we just don't have the data for the individual funds?
Correct. If you look at the pathway down below, it's the same situation where no one has historically reported the aggregate pathway relationship.
Got it.
We ask them to start parsing that apart. The data just doesn't
exist
historically within the mill.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
And that's all I had.
So if you look at your total fund, it's first quartile over all periods. You should congratulate yourself.
I do have a question about that because you did reference the Coombs report, and I was at Sackers recently, actually the week before last, and picked up that Coombs report. And one of the things that I noticed is your statement about being first quartile in all the trailing periods seemed to be true for everything except for the last 1 year ended June 30th, which it doesn't appear we're first
quartile. I was talking about ours against the investor force.
And yours is 9:30 and this is 6:30.
Yeah, so it's apples and oranges.
Okay, but I did want to just mention that if any of you wants this report that didn't get it, I do have an extra one that I picked up.
I can email it to anyone electronically if you want that. I have a scanned copy.
You have a scanned copy?
Yeah.
Yeah. I would like to have the scan.
Okay.
We'll make sure everyone gets it.
Let me shoot it. Yeah, I'll shoot it to Tim, and then Tim can post it to everyone if you want.
SAC is generally posted on the website, so if it's not there already, we'll shoot the scan.
Okay, and I mean the only comment I had is that 5 year, 10 year periods were right up there in the top four and top
one
on 10, four on 5 year, and then when we get to the 1 year annualized, we kind of drop down to the middle. And I was just wondering if anybody wanted to comment on why the last year we've.
That's when I joined.
Oh. Yes, that.
The simple answer is if you put together 10 slightly above average years, you end up being top of the pack. We're not ever striving to be an outlier in a short period of time. We're trying to make incremental gains there. So if you look, we are middle of the pack, but we're above the median, both the broad public fund median and the SACRS median on the one-year number. When you compound the slightly above average returns, you end up excellent long-term record.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. If you think about it this way, if you beat your benchmark portfolio by 1% per year over 10 years, at the end of that, you've got 10% of outperformance plus some compounding.
It's good stuff.
11, 12.
Tim, that was an eloquent tortoise and hare discussion, right?
Yeah. Bob, I'd just like to compliment you.
Thank you.
It was good going there, and it was good getting this report, and I was just proud as could be. I was busting buttons because I believe in long term, and in our 5 year and in our 10 year, we're there. We're above our shell that we had, the 7.5, then now 7.2, and it felt good to be on top and be in the top quartile and know that we were doing it right, or at least people were informing us the right way, and I thank Tim and I thank Carrie before and you guys for keeping us there. And hopefully, that 1 year will change over the next 3 years. And like you said, Marty, maybe we'll make 1% a year, and the 5 year will come back with 5% above the median. So I'm just glad, and we're doing well, and I think everybody should be happy with where we are and what we're doing. So thank you, Bob.
Well, and staff, and we're happy to take some of the credit. We'll point over here. Yeah. To these guys.
Don't grin too hard.
Okay. Anything further? Any other questions of our consultants? Maybe now is a good time to take that
hallelujah.
that break. Let's come back at 15:02.